The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well. So many developments, but we want to look at one of the theories early on. The Swedes tried it. It was reckoned it might happen in Brazil, where there were huge levels of infection of COVID-19, and that is herd immunity. So we're going to look at a particular place where herd immunity, if it was ever going to happen, was going to be very likely.
That's right, Pat. Manaus in Brazil was a big focus for this. They had a massive rate of infection, you know, say 6 months ago, I suppose, and then beyond. And then back in September, the health secretary said, oh, look, we've had a huge amount of infection. We would now have herd immunity. Don't expect a second wave, he said. But disastrously, they're in the middle of a huge upsurge in cases now. In fact, it's got so bad there, Pat, the special cemetery they built in a place called Park Taruma, you might have seen it on TV, that's now full. So it's just a shocking example of how you cannot get to herd immunity anyway quickly or anyway safely. So it's a real salutary tale, I guess. And then meanwhile, Pat, all the herd immunity advocates have gone quiet, you may have noticed. Remember the Barrington Declaration? That's now gone a bit quiet because this kind of data suggests it's a really dangerous thing to try and do because of the likely illness and death from it.
So in Manaus, people live in fairly cramped conditions, people living on top of each other. So if ever there was a place where it would spread and could spread, it was Manaus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 58% of people live in very poor, tightly packed conditions. You know, only 12% have access to good sanitation. So it's a very underprivileged part of the world, I guess. They probably got to about 60% infection overall, you see. And they were saying, oh, that might work and maybe that'll help. But it turns out it hasn't. And as I say, at the moment, it's amazing. Their state of emergency declared and all kinds of things. So the bottom line is, you know, you can't get to herd immunity naturally without causing a huge amount of illness and death is the sort of conclusion from this.
And President Bolsonaro's not exactly following the science.
No, he didn't help. I mean, he's being blamed, of course, because he said, look, let's have lots of parties around New Year's Eve. There was huge rallies for an election that happened there. So really, he misguided his people as well by suggesting. Again, they were trying to say, look, herd immunity is a possibility, but all the evidence said it wasn't, you know. But he was definitely seen as somewhat irresponsible in his recommendations.
Echoes of Trump, he described it as a little flu.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, precisely. He was paralleling Trump all through this, you know. And he's popular in Manaus. That was one problem. His party is very prominent there and they listen to him, you see. So again, there's a big spotlight now on Manaus and some of the decisions that were made, the advice that was given.
And this morning, just in case we are ever likely to become complacent, we've heard that there are 2,023 people in hospital and 400 are in high-grade dependency, including ICU, ICU being around the 200 mark, and the rest being cared for outside ICU. We're right in the middle of a massive surge, and the surge plan of the HSE has now been activated right across the country. So we're in a serious situation.
Exactly.
Let's move on to the vaccine, you know, the hope for everybody, the vaccine update. So talk to us about production of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, because we know that they've had to halt production at one facility while they expanded. So what is production looking like going forward?
Yeah, it's looking very good. They're going to make at least 2 billion doses in the coming months, which is a tremendous number of vaccines, obviously, you know. And they've got six different plants now, Pat, making them. It's amazing. They've got three in the US, one in Belgium. They bought a plant off Novartis, another rival company, and they can make 750 million doses a year in the Novartis plant. So they're now saying, look, there might be a little bit delay here and there. There was talk, wasn't there, last week of a week delay or so, but that isn't anything to worry about. They're ramping up production massively. It's been approved now in 45 separate countries, you know, separate jurisdictions have said, look, this is a great vaccine to use. So they're massively going as fast as they can. They know, Pat, of course, this is the way to help the whole world. If they can make billions of doses, this is the one that might do it, you see. And then Biden, of course, he's promised to do 100 million doses in 100 days of his presidency. He's asked Congress for $415 billion to help this process along, you see. So Pfizer are still way out front. They see themselves, Pat, as the pioneer as you probably know, they got there first, didn't they? Let's face it. And you have this what's called a first mover advantage in any kind of business, and they have it now.
They also know that their one is the trickiest to store and distribute because of the minus 70. So they've got to make hay while the sun shines, because on the horizon you've got Johnson & Johnson, a one-shot remedy vaccine, and you've got AstraZeneca, which may get approval in Europe by the end of the month. So you've got to get your stuff out there while you're still the only show in town, with the exception of Moderna, which is slightly less tricky to store and distribute, but not available in such large quantities.
That's right. It's an example of what a big drug company can do. These big pharma are superb organizations. They're like armies. If all the big drug companies are like massive armies, you know. So Pfizer have got their full force behind this. But you're quite right. They say we're out front. The efficacy holds up across all these different places. It's fantastic efficacy. 90%, of course, is the number there that they claim in the trial. It seems to be showing that in certain places, like in Israel, for instance. Israel have got there first with the big program, and the numbers are holding up there. So that's a very powerful thing for them to tell people. Look, ours is number one. And you're right, though, the tricky bit is the storage, I guess, and it's slightly more expensive, by the way, so we'll see how that plays out. But they will get those 2 billion doses out, watch, all over the world, is the prediction.
Now let's talk about the other vaccines that are looming. Sinovac is already out there. What's its efficacy like?
It's a funny one, because that's a Chinese vaccine, and they didn't publish much on it. You can't see many publications, one or two early phase two type studies published. But the big phase three hasn't been published yet. But instead, we're hearing from four different places of levels of efficacy. And one says 91%, another says 50%. It's a bit of a range here, I guess. They reckon it'll probably settle at about 70% efficacy for Sinovac. And that's a really good, anything over 50, Pat, is good, you see. So it looks like a very effective vaccine. And again, from the press releases, it seems very safe. That one's interesting, fact, because that one is a more of an old-fashioned kind of vaccine, in that they use the virus. The whole virus is in that. Now, it's been inactivated, so it can't infect you, obviously. But that would work against any variant, remember, because it's got all these different parts of it, you see, and the immune system makes antibodies to loads of parts, not just the spike. You know, everything can be recognized. That one could be a very useful one if these variants continue, say. But again, that one's being widely rolled out. Over 1 million people have been given that Chinese vaccine. It's state-sponsored in China, so it's all for free, you see. So, yeah, another vaccine, I guess, to add to the mix. And you never know, we might begin to ask for some of that if time. I mean, they're trying to expand the range of it, by the way. It will be available, I bet you, around the world. You know, and again, they're making billions of doses too. So it's another vaccine to add to the list.
Now, what about Johnson & Johnson? Because in terms of convenience, one shot and you're done, that would be terrific if it works.
That one's really interesting, Pat. It's called AD26-CoV-2S. Now, this I say the name, Pat, because that one could become the dominant one down the line, you see, because as you correctly say, there's evidence of one shot working really well. It would be one that would be easy to use, and it's much cheaper as well, but there's the price issue here as well. They're running two huge trials at the moment. One is the single shot, which we all think is the one that will make it. They're doing a double shot as well, just in case. The second shot might make things even better. But the single shot trial, they've just published data. They measured antibodies and T cells in people, and 90% of people had a high level of antibody by day 29, and 100% of people had it by day 57. That was the single shot. So after 57 days, everybody who was given that single shot had a massive level of antibody in their system, and then loads of T cells. This T cell side, that was really strongly boosted as well. So that would suggest now the single shot will definitely work. They're going to release the data, they said, on the 21st of January. We'll see the first scientific report of it. And then gradually in the 2 weeks or so after, the massive report will come out. They're applying already, Pat, for approval, of course. The FDA and EMA will have all the documents. That this rolling review process is happening, as you might know, where the agencies are given the data, you know, as it comes along. So again, we're expecting that one to be approved, I'd say, mid-February. And then there's the next one to come along, you see. And again, the European Union has bought 400 million doses, which is fantastic news altogether, to make available to everybody, including Ireland. So some of us are saying now that might be the one then that might begin to dominate the market, certainly say 3, 6, 9 months from now. It could be the Johnson & Johnson one. And then we've got AstraZeneca as well, which will be approved in the coming week or two too, you see.
It seems that the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, is having a rolling review of AstraZeneca. In other words, as they get the documentation, they're going through it, and it's expected that they will give it the nod on the 29th of January, and the EU then will quickly follow, possibly within hours. Talk of us trying to get a supply in advance of approval so that pharmacies and GPs would have it in their fridge because it can be stored in the fridge. So as soon as the nod is given from Europe, the following day, they could be jabbing people.
That makes perfect sense, Pat, doesn't it? It'd be fantastic if we can get it up front, but it's bound to be approved. I mean, there's no question it's EMA will approve it. So why not get into fridges now? And as you say, be good to go. It's a question of, again, access, I suppose. Clearly, they've got a supply issue to some extent. The UK are using it widely, as you know. So again, it's just a matter of getting enough of it out as quickly as possible. So it does make sense to try and get the order in early, I suppose. I mean, again, that one is really cheap. I mean, that's like an eighth the price of the Pfizer one. So it makes sense again to get that one going, doesn't it? I mean, we'll be in a position back where there'll be three approved in Ireland. Which one will be used, I suppose, is the question. And it will come down to supply and convenience, I guess, ultimately.
Yeah. Now, other things in the news. You may have seen in the Irish Times a protein discovery at UCD, your rivals, paves the way for anti-COVID drugs. And what's interesting is the UCD academic involved, Dr. Dennis Shields, is Professor of Clinical Bioinformatics.
Yes, I know Dennis very well, Pat. We had a great collaboration, me and Dennis, a few years ago. So he's a great one of these bioinformaticians, and they're very skillful, and we need them. They look at genomics and they look at protein sequences and use computers. He's a computer-based scientist, and he looked at COVID-2, and they've come up with what are called peptides, little tiny proteins that might lock onto ACE2, actually, and stop the ACE2 part of it. You know the way the virus has a spike that sticks into ACE2. He's discovering ways to stop the spike sticking in, I suppose, and allowing the virus into cells. And it's yet another good example of a really good research, you know, giving rise to what possibly would be a new drug. And what's nice from Dennis's work is these peptides can be made into drugs quite easily. So peptide-based drugs are quite well, you know, they're well studied and so on. So yet again, another possible weapon to use against COVID-2, using a very innovative way to do it. Nobody else would have that discovery. So Dennis deserves great credit for going. And he used a computer. Because you could look at the structure of ACE2, could you design little peptides to interfere with it? And that's exactly what they seem to have come up with. So it's another good example, I guess, of fundamental research.
Yeah. It'll be a while before they get these medicines, through animal testing, human testing and all the rest of it. But the idea would be that you could inhale this medicine and it would be a therapeutic for the people who still get COVID-19 in spite of a mass vaccination program. There will still be those who'll fall prey to it and have to be treated. But if the modelling that is going forward on COVID-19 is true, if the evolution of all of this happens the way the modelling suggests it might, we don't have to worry about it at all in some sort of medium-term future. What's going on?
This is a really strong paper, actually. It came out in Science. Now, Science is the world's best science magazine. Science and Nature are the two big ones that we're all dying to get into. You see, if you're a scientist, your dream is to publish in one of those two journals. So Science published this really fascinating paper predicting the future. Now again, for a grim Monday morning, I believe today's the saddest day of the year, but is it Blue Monday or whatever? So this is quite a good one because it's predicting the virus will become endemic, which means it becomes just like a regular virus and becomes like the common cold. And it was not a great fist to have ahead of us. And what they did was they compared it to the four common cold viruses out there already and to SARS-CoV-1, which is related they're all in the same family, you know, and they mapped how they became endemic, you see. So the prediction is this will eventually become endemic. Now, what they also say is imagine we're all vaccinated, Pat. Then it's when children come along, basically, right? But there wouldn't be any need to vaccinate children because they will catch it like they are now and they won't get sick, you see, because it's a very mild disease. And children, it's no different to the common cold. Now, there are very rare cases of problems. I'm not denying the importance of those by any means. But broadly speaking, it's like a common cold in a child. So you can imagine children will get it. They will build up resistance to it like they do to the common cold anyway. We know already if you have a cold, you might catch the same cold again. It'll be much milder, you know, so it's not a severe disease by any means. And then you just vaccinate the vulnerable, just like the flu, really. So we know it's a severe disease in older people and people with certain underlying conditions. But then as the population gets older, they're protected, you see, anyway, you know, because they've had it already in childhood. So you can imagine there how it becomes just, as I say, another, it's called endemic. So we're on the path from pathogenicity and pandemicity to endemicity is the word they use in the article. That's what they call this, you see. So that's the kind of a likely future for this particular virus. And the modelling was very, now it is based on modelling. So we have a pinch of salt, of course, because it is based on predictions. But the science there, the mathematics is very strong, you know.
Yeah. Meantime, at the moment, we're in the throes of a very severe situation. One News Talk listener saying, will you please appeal to all of your listeners to stay at home? Do not meet with other people. Keep within your own family unit. Do not allow your children to play with other units. Teenagers, stop mingling, please. Everybody stay at home. This virus needs people to survive. So don't feed it. So we are the food for the virus.
And Manaus tells us this, but the severity in Manaus is horrendous. I mean, the level of infection there is huge, huge mortality, huge illness is happening because the virus is running free there, you see. So they are trying to restrict it with their emergency measures. But that just shows you, this is still a very contagious, very dangerous virus. So that person was exactly right. Now is the time to stay home and just stay away for these next few weeks. It's really, really important because there are vulnerable people out there who will get very sick, you see, that's clearly the case. So but then remember that the VISTA remains, as we know, the vaccine program, and ultimately in a year, 2-3 years down the line, it becomes endemic, and then we're in a much better place by then. But right now we're in the eye of the storm.
Now, I've been banging on, as have you, about antigen testing and how useful it can be in particular settings. And I was wondering why the HSE hadn't moved on it, or why the politicians weren't pushing it. And I presume is, you know, they didn't really know, they didn't have a handle on it. But then I came across this HICWA report submitted to NPHET on the 7th of October, more than 3 months ago, and actually published on the 21st of October, which outlines exactly how it could be used. And, you know, pending a couple of pilot projects, you know, for schools, for clusters, and it's all laid out there very clearly, the usefulness. And that was endorsed again by the EU on the 18th of December, how antigen testing would be used, for example, in healthcare settings where you've got people staying at home because they had a contact with somebody, even though they might have been wearing PPE and all the rest of it, they had a contact, they are forced to stay at home. They may not be infected at all, and antigen testing daily could clear them to go on the ward. I mean, what do you make of this?
I don't know. Yeah, again, Pat, I read that as well because you sent it to me. It's amazing. That recommendation was strongly there, wasn't it? Now, why do they drag their heels on that one? And what disturbs me more is that the EU have said we should be using universal antigen testing. There was a great report done there, a woman called Stella Kyriakides. She's one of the health people in Brussels. And a great report says this is essential. It's a crucial thing to do. She said to slow down the spread of the virus. And even more, Pat, they've said the Abbott and Roche tests are good enough to do, you know, and in fact, the EU has bought 20 million of those tests, and they'd be available to Ireland on a pro rata basis. So why the antigen testing isn't being done more aggressively is still a surprise, isn't it? And you're right, it was back in October it was recommended. So it's still an unrelenting mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, and the Brits have bought hundreds of millions of the ANOVA tests. So, you know, other governments are active here. But they're talking about settings identified as having potential or confirmed outbreak or cluster infection. Yep. Settings with individuals at high risk of complications, for example, nursing homes. Settings in which workers are carrying out critical activities, such as healthcare workers. High density settings in which workers are present for long periods of time in prolonged close contact. And you could be talking about the meat factories there, or other places, settings in which expansion of test capacity is anticipated to significantly reduce the sample processing burden on local or regional laboratories. And it goes on. It's a very comprehensive report by HICWA, and it looks like it's been ignored.
It's been ignored. Yeah, exactly, Pat. And the big thing the EU say is these antigen tests offer speed and reliability, and they're the two things you want in an emergency. You want it to be very fast and very reliable. The PCR test is the gold standard, of course, but that just takes a bit more time, you know, a bit more effort. So the fact that it's quick and reliable, that's why it should be deployed in the way you say. The EU does say you still need a trained person to do it. In other words, it's not a case of us spitting in a tube and getting a plus or minus. That can be done, but that's a bit less reliable. You know, but it's easy to train people in the workplace. Yeah. Someone could be designated to do it for you.
Particularly where you have, you know, medical personnel in nursing homes, for example.
Exactly.
And you could certainly train someone up for school settings or university settings. And this is cheap. I mean, that's
very cheap.
It's very cheap.
you could designate one person in the school to train them. It doesn't, it's not much, it's not hugely complicated, but it's good to have someone who's trained in, say, in a school or in a workplace, could be given the task of monitoring this, you know. So that's what's happening in some places, for instance. So it is, it seems all extremely feasible at this stage. Early on, they were worried about that the kits weren't that good, or there was false negatives, false positives. But then eventually the EU said, no, Abbott and Roche, they have kits that are absolutely reliable, you see. So that problem went away in a sense, you know, and it just becomes one of the logistics as usual. I see in America, Pat, by the way, did you see this? They're looking for $415 billion now from Congress for their COVID campaign. $150 billion of that's for testing. And only $20 billion is to buy vaccines. So again, the US have seen testing as an absolutely critical thing to do to contain the spread of this, you see. And I bet that would involve widespread antigen testing as well. So even the US is onto this now as well. So we need to do more, basically, don't we, as quickly as we can.
Now, a couple of questions about the new variant. Is there evidence there yet that it is more infectious? Anecdotally, it is. And the other question is whether or not it attacks younger people and makes them sicker, because we're hearing about more young people being in hospital than heretofore. Yeah. Now, well, that could be simply statistical. You know, the more people who are tested, the more people who are positive, you're more likely to get more of everything in hospital, including young people.
Exactly. I mean, at the moment, yeah, the consensus now is it is more transmissible. That was questioned slightly early on. There was evidence for it, but now it's at least 50% more transmissible. This is the B117 strain that was first found in England, and that is more transmissible. Still good. Happily, though, no evidence it makes you more. It doesn't make you more sick, and nor does it really make young people sick either. And in fact, Pat, there's some evidence it might make you less sick, interestingly. So it's less pathogenic, but it's spreading more. You know, that's our current view of that variant. These are concerns about these new variants cropping up, though. They found another couple recently. So it's something that's being kept a very close eye on, for obvious reasons. You don't want this turning into something that's more nasty. But so far, all we have is increased transmissibility. That does impact, though, on this herd immunity concept, because you need to have higher coverage then in the population to slow it down if it's spreading more. Yeah. You know, so maybe that's one reason why the Brazilians didn't get there. There could be a variant there as well, part of that picture, you see. But at the moment, the main evidence is this is more transmissible.
Jerry in Colchester says, initially we were informed 15 minutes in contact with another individual puts you at risk of contracting COVID. Does the new strain alter this in any way?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, those times are a bit notional, it must be said. 15 minutes was sort of a number they picked, kind of, you know. It may well do, though, yeah, because it's more transmissible. The reason why whole households are getting infected, Pat, isn't just down to a new variant. It's just people indoors for longer in the winter. And this is the seasonal thing. You know, these viruses spread more in the winter because you're indoors for much longer times and the usual stuffy room idea, you see. But it's true, though. I mean, whatever way you look at it, you want to limit contact. That's the bottom line. Whatever the length of time might be, just make it as short as possible in these settings.
If two cautious individuals not known to have COVID from two different households only meet for outdoor walks in safe places such as a beach or parks, can the virus be passed from one to the other? Are these people considered to be close contacts? That's from Aideen in Dublin.
If you go outdoors and you keep the 2 metre, 1 metre, 2 metre distance, and it's a nice, you know, windy day, that's a safe thing to do. I wouldn't worry about that too much. You know, we've got to keep up our exercise and our social contacts is what's very important.
If you're worried,
well,
and you should wear the mask. I mean, maybe it's time for the government to say, listen, if you're outdoors in company, wear a mask.
That's right. That's exactly right. And people, there's a worry about masks, but there's less compliance I've heard about. People sticking in their pockets, you know, not washing them regularly. Keep an eye on the masks the whole time. They're a very important thing to use, as we know.
Andrew in Cork wants to know, they say the Spanish flu just went. Did it just go, or did people over time all get infected and build up immunity and it went endemic?
It became less problematic. There was a mutation there that was beneficial, so it became less pathogenic, so that the strain that eventually emerged was causing less disease. That's one, there's evidence for that, you see. And yep, secondly, immunity did begin to build up eventually in the population, you see. After a while, you did begin to go towards some kind of immunity in the population. So we reckon it was a combination of things, a less troublesome virus combined with, you know, I guess a bit of immunity. And then it did go in, yeah, it became endemic eventually and became another source of infection, I guess, in the community.
Now, here's an intriguing question. Can you ask Luke about the risks of contracting COVID after the first dose of vaccine? My wife tested positive after receiving the vaccine 3 days previously. I'm suggesting the vaccine gave it to her. No, will it limit the effects as she's quite ill?
No, we know it takes at least 11 days post-vaccination for antibody levels to begin to get to a high enough level to begin to protect you. So there's a lag, say, post-vaccination. And then we know if you get the second shot 21 days later, now you've got a fantastic immune system that really fights the virus. So there's a range there. There's no doubt that for a few days after vaccination, you're still at risk of infection. So you've got to just stick it out, you know, until your immune system really kicks in and starts to protect you. You've got to be careful post-vaccination, but not be careful anyway. I mean, remember, nobody should change their behavior after vaccination anyway, you know. But there's a tiny risk of infection post-vaccination that might go on for a few days. And that may be the reason why that person got infected.
A final question. I'm a postman. Oh, no, that's not the question. I'll mention the postman's comment in a moment. If you're taking methotrexate tablets, are you more vulnerable when it comes to COVID?
No, that's okay. Yeah, they look that closely now, by the way. I mean, many people are on immunosuppressants and they worry, oh, is that going to suppress my immune system and make me at a higher risk? There isn't a huge effect there. And they certainly don't recommend people coming off those drugs because then their disease might flare up and that might make them very ill, you see. So I wouldn't have any concerns there.
All right. For the moment, Luke, thank you very much for joining us. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin.